What is the Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah understanding on two things? I'll just review on fiqh and usul al-fiqh, because unfortunately in this day and age, just like a lot of people have misconceptions on tasawwuf, a lot of people have misconceptions on the madhab-based approach to Islamic jurisprudence. In reality, there are just two approaches. Either you take within the people of taqwa, of course there are people outside ilm and taqwa that are modernists and moderates and liberals and all of that, that is separate. But for those people who believe in halal and haram, for those people who believe that hijab is farz, that interest is haram, and all of that, you will find two positions amongst Sunnis. Those who believe that one should take a madhab-based approach to Islamic law and legal theory, and a second group which says that we should dispense with the madhab-based approach to Islamic law and legal theory. The Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah position is that you should take a madhab-based approach to Islamic law and legal theory, and the other position is sometimes refers to itself as Salafi or Al-Hadith, is sometimes referred to by others as Ghair Muqallid or Wahhabi. I think none of these terms are appropriate. We should simply call it non-madhab approach. That is the most fair, neutral, sensitive, scholarly term. And a lot of the problem happens when we use labels that can be incendiary, that can be inflammatory, or we engage in casting negative stereotypes. So we should stay away from that. We should not call one group blind followers. We should not call the other group fanatic Wahhabis. These are unfortunate labels that distort the situation. Actually, it is an ilmi discussion that do you want to take a madhab-based approach to Islamic jurisprudence, or do you think that we should dispense with a madhab-based approach to Islamic jurisprudence? That is the most fair, soft, balanced, sensitive way I can present this issue to you in English. The madhab-based approach to Islamic law and legal theory says that, number one, first let me start where both of them agree. Everyone agrees that there are certain things in the Quran and Hadith that are absolutely unequivocal and do not leave any room for disagreement or difference of opinion. In such cases, there is no need to follow any Islamic jurisprudence, let alone any quote-unquote approach to Islamic jurisprudence. One should simply do amal direct on the Quran and Hadith. For example, if you want to know how many rak'ahs are farz in Zuhr Salah, you do not need a madhab to tell you that. You do not need usul to tell you that. You do not need usulul fiqh to tell you that. You do not need a faqih writing a fiqh textbook to tell you that. You will do amal direct on the Quran and Hadith, and the Hadith will tell you clearly, unequivocally, that the number of rak'ahs for the farz of Zuhr Salah is 4. You don't need an interface between you and the text in these issues. Everybody agrees on that. Second, everybody agrees that there exist certain verses and certain ahadith that are open to multiple interpretation. This is there may be a few people who are in their passion, they try to deny this reality, but by and large, every single Islamic scholar has accepted this fact, that there are verses in the Quran and there are hadith in the Sunnah that are open to interpretation, that are emanating possible multiple meanings. Plus there are sometimes hadith that are in contradiction to one another. Right, the example we gave in the earlier workshop was the issue of Rafayadan. You will find hadith in Sahih Muslim to do Rafayadan. You will find mention of hadith in Sahih Muslim not to do Rafayadan. And you need to pray and you need to decide whether you're going to do Rafa'a then or not do Rafa'a then, right? And even if you take the high ground and think, okay, the Prophet ﷺ did both, there were Sahaba who did both, both are jais, bilakhraf, and khud pirbita fasta karna, right? Still, you as an individual need to decide how you are going to pray, right? Even if you're being soft and sensitive and say, my decision doesn't mean I'm negating the other side, doesn't mean I'm invalidating the other side, but still, at the end of the day, you need to decide. So, the way we interface, that is the science of usul. Sometimes it's usul al-tafsir, sometimes it's usul al-hadith, sometimes it's usul al-fiqh, but the science of usul is the interface between the scholar, not the arm person, between the scholar, not the arm person, between the scholar. Just like I say the science, the physics of electricity is the interface between the electrical engineer and the product he's designing. It's not the interface between me and that product, because I don't know anything about physics or electrical engineering. But the knowledge of usul is the interface between the scholar and the text when those texts are suggestive of multiple meanings, or there are multiple texts that may be in suggesting divergent meanings and even contradictory meanings to one another. That is how the whole science of usul, be it usul al-tafsir or usul al-hadith or usul al-fiqh, all three of them develop, because the scholar needs tools with which to interact and engage in those texts to be able to identify which text is going to be the basis of either what he writes in his tafsir, or what he writes in his commentary in that hadith, or what he writes in a book of Islamic law as what is the mas'ala, or what is the legal position on any known matter. And you know, part of the reason why the group that favors a non-madhhab approach to Islamic jurisprudence, the first difference is that there's an issue, and in their view, this issue falls in the first category, that the Quran and Hadith are absolutely clear on this issue. And the view of the people who take a madhhab approach is that no, actually, you know, it's not that clear. And this is the number one difference, actually, if I was to really simplify it for you, and again, we spent many, many hours on this in February, March, and April, but this one issue is what's caused all the confusion. And what you need is both sides to realize that they're looking at the issue differently. So that person who is coming from the perspective, he thinks that no, this one single sahih hadith, which is a khabar wahid, which is reported through only one sahaba, for them that one single sahih hadith is enough to wipe away all of the other evidence on the table. And therefore they think that the issue now is crystal clear and not subject to interpretation. And then they get really upset when they see someone else taking a different position. Now, why is the other person taking another position? It's because they don't think that that single sahih hadith is enough to solve the issue. They are looking at other evidences. They may be looking at other ahadith, they may be looking at Quran, they may be looking at amal of sahaba, they may be looking at fatwa of sahaba, they're looking at other things. So for them, the matter is not resolved. So both agree that if the matter is unequivocally resolved by the text, then you don't need usul. But the difference is that one person thinks it has been resolved and the other one doesn't think it's resolved. Because one person is only looking at one sahih hadith and the other one is looking at a whole series of other things. Just to give you an example and to also illustrate to you that this is not some Arab Desi thing. And a lot of people in Pakistan have misunderstood this. They think this is an Arab versus Desi thing, or they think this is a Salafi versus Hanafi thing. Nothing could be further from the truth. And first of all, you should know that the vast majority of Arabs are still on the Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. But the Arabs that Pakistanis interact with are Saudi and Gulf Arabs, which are very, as you know, very small populations. Arabs are Egyptians and Jordans and Syrians and Iraqis, right? And Mauritanians and Moroccans and etc. And Syria, for example, is majority Hanafi and minority Shafi. And in a handful of Salafis, it's like 50% Hanafi, 40% Shafi, and 10% Salafi. Iraq is 80% Hanafi. The Arabs, who are Sunnis, and the Kurds, who are Sunnis, are Shafi. There's hardly any Salafi presence in Iraq. Jordan is a mix, Palestine is a mix, Egypt is largely Maliki, right? But because we go on Umrah and Hajj, or many Pakistanis live and work in Jeddah, Riyadh, Dammam, Dahran, etc., we have interaction with a very small subset of Arabs. So to give you an example, Imam Malik, rahimahullah, Imam Malik sometimes in his Muwatta, which is the book of Hadith, he actually mentions the hadith is 110% sahih, and then he writes, it's a very famous sentence of his, La na'khudhu bihi, hum istidlil nahi pakadte. We don't use it. We don't do amal on this hadith. Allahu Akbar. And see, and that's why I always find it so funny that sometimes people use this, not against Imam Malik, people say, oh look, falah alim, hadith ke khilaf jara. I took a forget falah alim, look at Imam Malik, he himself is narrator of hadith, he himself is compiling the hadith, he himself is teaching. The Muwatta is a book that was written by different scribes who were students of Imam Malik. So actually Imam Malik is teaching hadith in Medina Munawwara to, and he is of the Tabai Tabin, and he's teaching hadith in Medina Munawwara to other Tabai Tabin in Masjid Nabawi, he says the hadith right next to the roza and says, La na'khudhu bi. We don't do amal on it. So why? Is it because Imam Malik, na'udhu billah, doesn't love the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam? No way. Is it because Imam Malik does not an alim of hadith? No way. Is it because Imam Malik prefers his own ijtihad over hadith? That is also kufr. How can you prefer your own ijtihad over the sunnah of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam? It's because Imam Malik is looking at something else. What Imam Malik used to say, and this is his usul, we can agree or disagree with it, but the point is at least we should understand it, right? And Imam Malik, his usul was, that look, I don't just look at the textual reports of the practice of the Prophet ﷺ, I also look at the practice of the Sahaba. And specifically, he looked at the practice in Medina. And he was a Tabai Tabin, which means he's a student of the Tabin, right? If you were here yesterday, I already explained that to you. And he saw that all of the Tabin of Medina do not do Rafa Yadain. So he says, all of Tabin of Medina do not do Rafa Yadain. On the one other side, I have one Sahih Hadith that says, do Rafa Yadain. For he would say, one Sahih Hadith is what? One Sahaba. So he said, I have one Sahaba's call that it is Sunnah to do Rafa Yadain, and I have all of these Tabin's Amal that it is Sunnah not to do Rafa Yadain. So you would look at that. Because his view is that the Amal of Medina preserves the Sunnah. Because the Tabi'in that he saw, because he was the student of the Tabi'in, those Tabi'in must have met the Sahaba. Who taught them to pray Salah? The Sahaba of Medina. And maybe one or two could have missed Rafa Yadain, but for all of the Tabi'in of Medina to miss out on it, it must mean that they were taught to do Salah by the Sahaba of Medina to not do Rafa Yadain. It's just an example I'm giving you, right? So for one scholar who picks up and looks exclusively at one Sahih Hadith, he thinks that the issue is settled. For him, this issue now falls in first category, that I told you that when the Quran and Hadith are unequivocal, absolutely crystal clear, and the evidence is clear as the light of day on an issue, then you don't need usul and madhab and ijtihad and fiqh, you just do amal on the Hadith. So scholar one puts this issue in that area, because they're only looking at that Sahih Hadith. Scholar number two has expanded his workshop. And he looks at hadith, he also looks at amal of sahaba, also looks at fatwa of sahaba, is looking at other things as representations of the sunnah. Scholar number two views the amal of sahaba as another representation of sunnah. Not just their textual transmissions, but also their lived life. And for scholar number two then, this issue is not settled. For scholar number two, this issue comes in category number two, in which the workshop of different sources of understanding of our deen is leading to multiple possible meanings. And so really that's when sometimes, and unfortunately many times, the people on the first side don't understand that, or they don't acknowledge that. And that's why they use lots of fiery rhetoric. You know, that fiery rhetoric. Are you going to follow Imam Malik, or are you going to follow the Prophet ﷺ? Are you going to follow Abu Hanifa, or are you going to follow the Prophet ﷺ? Are you going to follow a Deobandi Mufti, or the Prophet ﷺ? Allahu Akbar. Well, I would pick Prophet ﷺ. What do I care about Deobandi Mufti? Are you going to follow Deobandi Mufti or Sahih Bukhari? Right? Asume, everybody is following the deen. It's just a question of how expanded or constricted is our understanding of the sources of the deen. What do we just view as a source? If you view Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim as the only sources of the deen after the Quran, then yes, if that is your usul, that itself is an usul. If that is your principle, that is your methodology, then a lot of issues that for the ulama of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah, for the fuqaha, mujtahideen, Imam Shafi, Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, even Imam ibn Taymiyyah, ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah, for Imam al-Ghazali, for all of them, for them, because they expanded their understanding of sources, they saw many more nuances. But if we're going to restrict our sources to Bukhari and Muslim, then we won't see those multiple interpretations won't come out. To give you an example of the hadith scholar's understanding of fiqh. So you see, one is an alim of the chains of hadith, the chains of narration. The great ulama of the chains of narration were people like Imam Bukhari, Imam Muslim, Imam Tirmidhi, Imam Abu Dawud, and they used their knowledge of narrators, and they used their knowledge of the chains of narration to compile books of hadith that me and you still use to this day, and the entire ummah is indebted to them for using their incredible knowledge of the chains of hadith to compile these books. There's a second type of muhaddith, and he is an alim not so much of the chains of the hadith, he is an alim of the meanings of hadith. And these are those muhaddithin who write commentaries on the hadith books. So I'm going to give you an example of the two universally acknowledged by everyone as the two of the greatest alims of hadith. Number one, who is universally acknowledged as the greatest alim of Bukhari, his name is Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani, and he's written a commentary called Fathul Bari on the Sahih of Bukhari. And Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani was Shafi in madhab. Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani openly, repeatedly professes his adherence to the Shafi madhab in his book. Such a big alim of hadith, but the greatest alim of Bukhari, but even then he felt that when it comes to Islamic jurisprudence, I'm going to follow a madhab-based approach. I'm going to take a set of usul and base my understanding of those issues that are not resolved by the text alone, but require some type of methodology, some type of principle, some type of hermeneutics, some type of usul to resolve them. I'm going to follow a madhab for them. Second, the greatest alim of the Sahih of Muslim is Imam al-Nawawi. Imam al-Nawawi has written the greatest commentary, Sharah ala Sahih Muslim. And Imam al-Nawawi, rahimahullah ta'ala, also Shafi. Also Shafi. And openly, and nobody has denied this in history, there are a few extreme people from one side who are trying to do what in Western social sciences we call revisionist history. That they're trying to rewrite history such that it is a narrative that leads to their conclusion. This is called revisionist history in the Western Academy. That you reconstruct the historical narrative so that that narrative leads to your position. A handful of people are trying to go back and rewrite the history and the views of Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani of Imam al-Nawawi. Otherwise, 99% of the ulama of this ummah from whatever side have had to submit to this historical fact that Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani and Imam al-Nawawi, both of these two greatest alims of hadith, chose to follow a madhab-based approach to Islamic law and legal theory. All of this I was mentioning to get a feel for the Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah. And in my own view, I actually include Ibn Taymiyyah and Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah in Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah. And having had the fortune and the fazl of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, only His fazl and grace, to have read these two authors widely, I have come to the conclusion that 80 to 90% of what they said and wrote was in complete concordance with Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah. And it's only 10 to 20% where they came up with positions on the basis of their own scholarly knowledge, their ilm, and their taqwa. But they came up with positions that were departures from the classical Islamic scholarly tradition. What's unfortunate is that the way that they are represented in English and in Urdu is just that 10 and 20%. And so when you read English books or Urdu books, even translations of Ibn Taymiyyah, they select those works of his and those passages of those works of his in which he has departed from the tradition. And therefore you will think that it's totally something different. So an average person will be given this impression that Ibn Taymiyyah and Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah on one side, and Imam Hanifa, Imam Malik, Imam Shafi, Imam Ahmad al-Hanbal, and all of their students, Nawawi, Ghazali, etc., on the other side. But it's not really like that. And Ibn Taymiyyah and Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah were by and large Hanbali. There were a few excesses that took place in their time. There were a few people who were very partisan towards a madhab, such that they were becoming extreme partisans for a madhab. And Ibn Taymiyyah and Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah took kind of a reaction to that. And the reaction was justified, but sometimes the extent of the reaction was a little bit too harsh. In particular, Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah, and I've been reading this book of his, and I actually brought it with me in Arabic, Ilam al-Muqtayin, his section on taqleed is very harsh. Allahu Akbar. Very harsh. Right? But when one person understands him, and a person should still love him for all the other incredible work that he has done, and even love him for this, because he wrote that out of his ikhlas. His niyat was pure. Right? And it's unfortunate that the way that this is presented to the masses is a very confrontational thing. But these are, scholarly disagreements. and they can only be understood and appreciated and kept in context and not made a source of fitna by the scholars. But when you let these scholar disagreements spill over into the masses, then it becomes discord, it becomes fitna, and it becomes confrontational.